Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
A voice of reason in the medical world. Dr. Fred Brown from Griffin Health talks to Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
All right, Dr. Brown, we are opening things up to 12 to 15-year-olds today. You ready for this?
Are absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I know there are a lot of people who are excited, but then there are also a lot of people who feel like this moved very quickly, that it felt like Pfizer kind of put it out there last week. Hey, we would like to get this approved for 12 to 15-year-olds. And then a week later, boom, here we are. Could you maybe respond to that? Do you feel like things moved too quickly? And if they did not, could you explain sort of the process they went through to get the 12 to 15-year-olds approved?
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, you can get that it moved quickly, or you heard about it and then all of a sudden it's there. But that wasn't actually a Pfizer thing. That was more of a press thing. So that in relation to sort of what's out there and what are we talking about. Pfizer and Moderna and the other vaccine companies have been working on the different age groups, you know, since this came out, actually even before that. So it's actually not a new thing. I think it's just, again, the announcement. And no company really wants to make an announcement unless they're comfortable saying that this is something that we want to move forward with. The interesting thing is that I know there's some concerns about the rush. This is not a different vaccine. This is the same vaccine that we've been using since the start. It's even the same dosage. So it's exactly the same vaccine. So this is an extension study in the original study. So the original study, you could say, okay, we did, you know, over 100,000 people who have actually, you know, were in the initial study, and then the millions of people that have actually got it outside of the study are actually in this next sort of phase four we're currently monitoring outside. So you can infer from that data how people are responding to it, how the actions are going, and then you can actually have a smaller study group to say, okay, is this safe and effective in children? And that's what this study was. So again, this isn't a logical transition of any vaccine or any medical study to sort of add out a different subgroup.
Okay. Now, Dr. Brown, really quick before I continue on talking about this, you mentioned like Moderna, some other vaccine companies looking to expand their vaccine to younger demographics. And correct me if I'm wrong, Moderna was actually the first one to say, hey, we're going to try this out on 6 months and older. Wasn't it Moderna who they were the ones who were saying we're going to start trialing it on younger patients, or am I crazy?
No, you're absolutely right. And honestly, it comes down to recruitment, which actually should be, I mean, I think your listeners should be comfortable to know that they, you know, they just haven't had enough people, enough data to come out with it.
Yeah, because I haven't heard anything about Moderna, like in months. I haven't heard anything about their younger demographic. I remember when they first announced it, I think it was Yale, I don't remember who it was, but somebody said, you know, I can't wait to sign my kid up for the clinical trials. And then I haven't heard anything about it since.
Yeah. And it's still happening.
Okay.
I can comfortably say that it is still happening. But again, it's you know what, there's a significant amount of rigor associated with these extension studies, getting the volunteers. And then also, not only do you have to have volunteers that'll get the vaccine, there needs to be volunteers that are not going to get the vaccine and that you're going to monitor, so what we call the placebo group. And then that placebo group, this is going to sound kind of bad, but then you need to compare people who get infected versus not infected.
Well, sure,
of
course.
So if you have a placebo group and nobody gets infected, then you can't. There's no comparison there.
Right. Of course.
These studies can take a while.
So here's another question I have for you, Dr. Brown. 12 to 15. I get the high school group, 14 and 15-year-olds. Why 12? Like, so when I think about 12 and 13-year-olds, you're talking about 7th and 8th graders, but like not 6th graders. I'm always curious, like, how do you determine age brackets? And then, you know, it's interesting, like Pfizer now is going as low as like toddlers. So like the next age bracket is basically from like 2 to 11, which is a much wider scheme of people. So I'm curious, like, how do you even determine 12? How do you, Dr. Brown?
Why would that be the group that I went into the you know, essentially the the teenagers are close to it. I know 12 years old and teenagers, but the reason is that that group of adolescents, and again, I don't think I could just give you my theory. My theory is that group would not need to have any modification in the current dosage that's being used because of their size. I think it's actually, honestly, I think it's a size issue.
Size issue. A
12 to, you know, a 12 to, you know, 12 to 15 year olds are, you know, are getting into that size where they're, you know, above a certain weight, and therefore they probably wouldn't have to modify the vaccine. There's going to be a question about anybody younger, you know, is there going to need to be any modification of that vaccine?
Gotcha. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And again, we're talking to Dr. Brown with Griffin Health, as we do every Thursday. And if you have any questions for him, don't worry. He'll be sticking around for another few minutes. Dr. Brown, you know, with the rollout of the vaccine, we've been slowly seeing like our infection rate go down. I think yesterday was the first time we saw it at its lowest in a very long time, 1% positivity rate.
Yes.
I'm curious, you know, I always love to see like what our hospital trends look like. It was funny. I was talking to one of my colleagues here, Paul, who works in the afternoons. And Paul was saying, oh, I was looking at this hospital out in, you know, I don't know, some other state. And he's like, and it shows that the majority of the hospitalizations, they are people who don't get vaccinated. And I said, just talk to the hospitals here in Connecticut. Like, they'll tell you the same thing. Dr. Brown said the same thing. Most of the people who are hospitalized don't have the vaccine. But we're now below 300 in the hospitals. Are we still seeing the same thing? It's mostly people who are not vaccinated?
That's exactly right, Melissa. It's mostly people who are not. I'm not saying mostly. I said it's all people who have not been vaccinated.
Really?
I have not seen anybody. And there's interesting, the state did come out with some numbers on how many people they've detected that have actually had the vaccine and developed it. And as far as I'm aware, I don't know of, I mean, I'm sure there's some complications and other issues, but as far as I'm aware, there has not been an admission directly related to someone who's actually had the vaccine.
Interesting.
So yes, it's majority are still those who haven't got it. And yes, we have seen a significant decline, which is excellent. We're now seeing, you know, we're seeing less than 5% in the hospital now. Unfortunately, these are the patients who are sick, and they've been here for, you know, they've been here for a while from sort of the last round.
Quickly, Dr. Brown, before we just break for traffic and weather, when patients get released from the hospital, like we're seeing, it was like 28 patients released yesterday. Say they are people who have not gotten their vaccine. Is there like a bigger effort to either I don't want to say educate because I'm sure they're very educated, but like convince them, I guess, to get the vaccine? Like, are there stronger pushes to say, hey, you want to stay out of here? Let's get the vaccine. Like, is that effort happening, do you know, from the hospital level when they're released?
Yes, it is. And as you know, the vaccine utilization is actually going down. So that's obviously a concern. And it's a concern, sort of what we talked about from last week. So yes, the hospitals are focusing on our patients, you know, those who have not been vaccinated. We are focusing on how do we get them vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So if they've come into a hospital, and a lot of hospitals now are offering it to the patients that are leaving, not just those who had COVID-19.
Wow. Okay.
So that is happening because, again, those are the higher risk. Our concern is that if we don't vaccinate or continue to vaccinate patients, because we were on that cusp of that herd immunity, the issue is that we may not get a widespread outbreak in the state, but we may get certain towns, counties that will actually have potential upticks.
Mm-hmm.
So clusters or outbreaks. So we want to be really careful about those.
So whether or not you are a Yankees fan or not, you've probably noticed the Yankees are in the top headlines this morning in every newspaper because the New York Yankees are dealing with 7 breakthrough COVID cases. 3 coaches, 4 support staff members all have been confirmed positive. And reports this morning are saying 6 out of 7 of them were asymptomatic. Now, my understanding, Dr. Brown, is that they all got the J&J vaccine. So my question, first of all, is do you think that's a large percentage of positive cases when the shot is supposed to be over 60% effective?
I don't really, given sort of the nature of, you know, sporting and sort of the combination, I still think it's important to keep in the back of the mind that we need to be careful, you know, that close contact for an extended period of time, if someone actively has the virus, then it can be spread. So again, we are seeing that. And honestly, the J&J does have a lower efficacy rate, so that is, you know, that is a little bit more of a concern. So it's easier to overcome sort of that over that amount, you know, the amount of virus that you would need to get infected.
Now, I might be completely wrong, Dr. Brown, and I actually could be very wrong. Do we know if sports players, Christian, you may know the answer to this. Do we know if sports players are required to get the vaccine? The reason I ask this question is because if they're not required, but the teams are encouraging it. Okay, yeah. Thank you for that. So I guess my question was going to be, if you've got the majority of the team, though, even if they got the J&J vaccine, shouldn't that be herd immunity?
Well, as we talked about before, herd immunity isn't an all or nothing. You still need to take, you know, some level of precaution. And having too many people and not having, you know, and again, having one person that's not been vaccinated or someone of the staff that's not been vaccinated and that they are symptomatic and they're spreading it, that's obviously the concern. So herd immunity is not 100%. Herd immunity just means that if it's going to spread, two things are going to happen. One is that it is going to potentially spread, but it'll be limited. And the second thing is that what we're seeing is exactly what you're seeing with the New York Yankees, is that we're seeing is that those who have been vaccinated are asymptomatic or mild. Some people do get a flu-like illness, but it's definitely not a hospitalization.
Gotcha. Okay. I mean, I would think that this, to me, is a very jarring example of how, you know, it's a tool. I think there's always this misconception that, like, the vaccine is a cure. And it's not a cure. It's a very strong tool in your toolkit that can help protect you or make, you know, COVID symptoms, keep you out of a hospital, essentially. So I guess my question to you, Dr. Brown, is if you have people this morning going, okay, so I did what you asked me to do. I got the vaccine. I want to go back to normal. But then you watch what happened here with the Yankees, and now they're going, you know, what gives kind of thing.
Right.
This is what you're sort of talking about, though, is we could see these pockets of infections.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's not an all or nothing. You still think about it. If you think about it like the flu. I mean, everybody knows that you can get the flu shot and you can still get the flu. It's just more concentrated. There's just more people who have not ever had COVID-19. So there's a likelihood, if it gets into this population where no one's had COVID-19, that it's just going to spread that much faster.
Mm-hmm.
So again, herd immunity is really about not spreading it around the world. It's really about keeping it isolated. But again, you can have these individual outbreaks like you did with the New York Yankees, even with a vaccine, because, you know, there was someone who probably got exposed and was feeling unwell and potentially came to work. It's very unlikely that they were asymptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
The person who probably started this had some symptoms or had some significant symptoms.
Interesting. All right. Well, Dr. Fred Brown at Griffin Health, thank you so much for coming on again, taking our questions this morning. Always appreciate chatting with you every week. Thank you.
My pleasure, Melissa.
All right. We'll talk again next week.
And now, a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal on WICC 600.
Well, Senator Blumenthal, some great news this morning. The pipeline is back online, but it was a pretty scary situation. Some states actually running out of gas or having to pump up their actual prices significantly in the last couple of days. I wanted to kind of dive into this morning what we're doing on the national level to better combat hacking situations, because this was like a cyber attack, a malware attack, which is interesting because we just went through a malware attack just about a few weeks ago when it came to like our emissions testing here in the Northeast. So what is being talked about on the national level when it comes to hacking?
That's a great question, Melissa, and very timely now because of the colonial attack on that pipeline that provides about half the fuel to the East Coast. And fortunately, now it's back in operation, but it will take a while to be fully delivering fuel and gasoline up and down the East Coast. The other recent hacks, for example, the Microsoft Exchange hack by China, the SolarWinds hack by Russia, these attacks are unprecedented in their magnitude, and thereby foreign states. But they're also the hackers like the ones who did Colonial, who were just a criminal enterprise, likely located in Russia? And the answer to your question is we are doing nowhere near enough. The utilities are doing nowhere near enough in the private sector, and the government is doing nowhere near enough. President Biden yesterday ordered a new set of rules that require government contractors to report data breaches and a new cyber board. But I have asked many of our military leaders about this issue in Armed Services Committee hearing, and I am nowhere near satisfied that we're doing enough to protect our national defense agencies, let alone utilities. So we need to harden our defenses to keep out these hackers, but also to mount a deterrent effort. An offense is a good defense, and make sure that our adversaries like Russia and China understand that we're going to respond appropriately and proportionately in kind, and that hopefully will deter them.
What does, when you talk to the military, Senator Blumenthal, what are they telling you? Like, what are their suggestions?
Well, without going into the classified responses, essentially they recognize the problem, and they know we need to have the cyber domain weapons and perhaps to exercise them in order to show our adversaries and the private hackers, like the ones involved in this criminal exercise, that they will pay. General Nakasone, who's one of the chief of leaders in our intelligence community, testified about a year ago in the cyber domain. He said, our adversaries do not fear us. I asked him the other day whether our adversaries fear us now, and the answer is clearly no.
So I know that we can't obviously share classified information, but when you say cyber domain weapons, what are we talking about?
We're talking about the same kinds of weapons that they are using against us to infiltrate and hack our system. We have that capability. We use it only very, very sparingly.
Is that because we're nervous of, like, counter getting a worse hacking situation done to us? Like, if we go against them using weapons, that it's going to only be worse, like a backlash? Is that why we don't use them?
That's the classic argument, Melissa. In other words, the danger of escalation.
Sure.
Similar to the nuclear domain.
Sure, sure.
Where the use of a single nuclear weapon could prompt a major nuclear war, and mm-hmm. it has provided for nuclear deterrence that has kept us out of war. And that's why we're rebuilding our nuclear deterrent capability by constructing another set of submarines, the Columbia class, right here in Groton, Connecticut, that will replace the Ohio class submarines and provide a third leg of the nuclear triad as a measure of deterrence. But in this instance, the difference is that, as they say, the proverbial 15-year-old hacker sitting on a couch in some third world country could try to hack into our system. And if he's smart enough and we are defenseless, he might be able to do it. Now, instead of the 15-year-old hacker, you have a real criminal enterprise, seemingly professional in their capability, doing its colonial, a major pipeline on the East Coast, and crippling our fuel delivery, which is a matter of very severe national interest.
Well, and I think, Senator Blumenthal, if I may, I think that's kind of the risk that we take is, you know, what's scary about these hacking situations is we don't know who's on the other end of them. We don't know if it's a sketchy 15-year-old or if it's somebody who has highly classified intelligence and knows things that we've provided in some way or that have leaked in some way. I think that's the scary part of this.
And the danger of the SolarWinds hack, you'll recall a number of months ago, by the Russians, is in fact it penetrated our defense agencies, at least to some degree, possibly, as well as other government agencies and private enterprise. So going back to your very first question, we need to harden our defenses. There are ways to erect stronger means of keeping them out. And we also need to deter them.
All right, Senator Richard Blumenthal. I do have one more question really quickly before I let you go. I know earlier this week you wrote a letter to airlines urging them to refund or credit customers who could not travel during the pandemic. Did you get a response from them yet?
We have not received a response. Consumers deserve those refunds because they paid for tickets or other service and they didn't get it. So they deserve money back.
Yeah, I agree with you. And one more thing, Senator Blumenthal, sorry for the last minute question, but we have another tractor trailer situation this morning getting stuck on the connector in the Milford area, you know, on the way to the Merritt Parkway. I don't know for sure. I'm just making an educated guess that this might be a GPS app problem, which I know you have pushed for. Have we gotten any traction on fixing GPS apps that these truck drivers are using so that they avoid getting stuck on the Merritt Parkway or other places where they're not allowed to be driving?
I'm not familiar with that particular incident. I'm in D.C. right now.
It just made me think of it this morning. Yeah.
But I've received no response to the recent letter from any of those companies.
Okay. Well, Senator Blumenthal, we appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much. And we'll talk again next week.
Talk to you then. Thank you.
Stephanie Swantek is here with the Be Safe Project out of Bridges Healthcare in Milford. And today, Stephanie, we're talking about expectations. Why is this an important topic?
So, good morning. I guess in regards to expectations, it doesn't really matter how old you are or where you come from. Expectations are a good thing for ourselves to hold, again, for ourselves. But a lot of times we put those expectations on other people, and we base kind of our satisfaction or our happiness or things in our lives based on other people's expectations or their response to us. And so in a way, it can really hurt us if we're not kind of in control, in charge, and aware of those who realistically deserve our expectations and what are healthy expectations to set.
And you know what's crazy, Steph, about expectations is I think a lot of times we kind of pre-decide in our minds what we expect from people, but we never actually literally tell people what we want from them. You know what I'm saying? Like we almost expect mind readers from people, including like our spouses, for example.
Yes. Again, expectations, it really does kind of leak into things like communication and just kind of, again, all those healthy relationships, but with yourself as well as others. And realistically, if you really think about it, if I'm putting kind of unobtainable expectations onto others, I'm setting them up for failure.
Mm-hmm.
And so how that failure can also, it can also affect other people and it can impact other people, or I'm putting expectations on people that have never shown up for me ever. So if I'm expecting them to show up now, I'm realistically already punishing myself because they're going to hurt me because they never showed up for me prior.
That's so true. You know, but it's interesting, Stephanie Swantek, who's with the Be Safe Project out of Bridges Healthcare. It's interesting, though, because we naturally will do that. I know just from personal experience, there's a family member of mine who has always been kind of a flake, literally since we were kids, has always just been that way. And it's amazing how, like, in my adult life, since having a son, I expect them to show up for my son. And my husband has to often say, why? Like, are you crazy? And I think to myself, I must be. So why do we naturally create these expectations for people who, like you said, have never been in the picture, really?
I think a lot of us, like, I think naturally as human beings, we are hopeful, a lot of us, unless we're completely burnt out, right? But in general, like, we are hopeful and we always want the best. But that's that, like, delineating line of, okay, I can always hope, but I can't expect that. Don't expect them to be there. If they're there, that's like a cherry on top of a sundae, but don't expect them to be there because then we're just letting ourselves down. And if we have children, those people depending on us.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to creating expectations for people, like you said, this does end up having almost a trickling effect on your communication, whether it's with your spouse, a family member, a friend, a colleague, anything like that. So how do we start to recognize that, hey, I've created these lofty expectations. I don't even think I've ever verbally told anyone what they are. But even so, even if you have communicated that, how do we pull ourselves back, not only from having these high expectations, but also realizing that it's kind of unfair for us to put people at such a high standard when maybe we aren't meeting other people's expectations, right? Like, there's also the other side of the coin that people may put expectations on us and we'll go, that's not fair. So how do we break that down a little bit?
So I mean, it's, yeah, so communication. So, but again, starting with yourself, of what do you expect from yourself, and then, again, breaking it down of what do you expect from others. So having that conversation with yourself, and how, and whatever that may be. So it's like how you show up for others. Like, do you show up on time? Do you show up, you know, do you offer? Do you, whatever it may be, can people healthily depend on you, or do they not? And kind of, again, do your own work and kind of raise your awareness of those things. And then for those people that you actually feel safe and comfortable talking to, without, again, that, where we talk about that judgment and that shame, approaching them and then asking them, like, what do you need from me? You know, how can I be that best friend or best partner in this situation? Or how have I not shown up for you? If you're comfortable having that conversation and really being vulnerable and working on that. But then if they say, I need you to do X, and you're like, oh, I can't meet that expectation, being honest about that and seeing where that relationship goes.
Mm-hmm. And Stephanie, I have to imagine that this is something, I know even for myself, it actually took going to like a marriage counselor for my husband and I before we got married to really break down, because we both had these expectations of each other once we entered marriage that neither of us even knew about. So for us, it was a counselor. For other people, it may not be. And maybe it's getting your expertise or getting your tips on this to kind of better break down those barriers and to have a better understanding of the damage of expectations. How can people reach out to you?
Absolutely. So I'm always available. And my direct line is 475-202-2827. And again, with all these expectations, right, from our looks and our, and, you know, so kind of superficial things, as well as, again, like expectations with based on other people and people showing up for us, as well as expectations for ourselves. If you want to compare it to something just like cooking, right, cooking always takes usually a little longer than you thought, as well as the cleanup and X, Y, and Z. So kind of always basing your expectations on something realistic, and again, something that's not perfect, because when it is, that's when we let ourselves down.
Stephanie Swantek of the Be Safe Project out of Bridges Healthcare, thank you so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.